and they join us here this morning at WBCN. Gentlemen, good morning.
Pleasure to be here.
If you drive to the Giza Plateau in Cairo, you see apartment buildings, you see fast food restaurants, you're on a two-lane road that's become, because it's Cairo, six lanes of traffic, and suddenly there is ancient history and the desert. Most people don't realize just how threatened these monuments are.
That's a tremendous challenge. In the old days, you could see the pyramids much sooner when you were driving down that road. And it seems every year the buildings encroach and encroach. But the Egyptians are doing everything they can to try to protect the site. It's a great challenge.
Modernity is literally encroaching on the ancient world.
Absolutely.
Well, in ancient times, the pyramids were really in the desert. You could see them from Cairo on a clear day. Sometimes you can do that even now. And there are pyramids in Egypt outside of Cairo where it's not so unlike the way it used to be. You can see the green of the cultivation, and you can see them rising in the distance. But the pyramids are close to an enormous city. They're so large, they're so famous, and they're popular. And the road was built only in the 19th century. Before that, in the old days, it wasn't so easy to get to the pyramids. You can do it. People did it all the time, but it wasn't a matter of getting into a taxi cab and all of a sudden having these immense monuments looming up right in front of you.
Giza is a special place. The Sphinx and three pyramids, perhaps the most famous constructions in the world.
Certainly right up there. That's one of the great privileges we have at the Museum of Fine Arts, to be able to work with this site that we have such an intimate connection to. But it's not only so famous, but it's also a great struggle to try to preserve all the data and the materials that we have related to it.
What else is on the site in addition to the Sphinx and the three pyramids?
There are the cemeteries of the people who built the pyramids, who served the king, and all of their families. So in addition to the royal cemeteries, the kings and the queens, we have the high officials, and we have other people who formed the top notch, the elite of Egyptian society during this period.
These are hundreds and hundreds of tombs surrounding the pyramids, and they're tombs that the average tourist doesn't often get to see.
Do we know when and why construction began?
Well, with each new pharaoh of the Old Kingdom, they seem to want to choose a new site for their pyramid complex. And we do have some evidence of previous occupation at Giza. But Khufu, around 2600 BC or so, seems to have chosen the Giza Plateau as his favorite burial ground. And he's the one who really began all the massive construction at the site.
And is the Sphinx older than the pyramids?
Larry, you want to try that one?
Well,
good controversy.
I don't think so, but of course there are. The Sphinx is such a fantastic monument that there's a lot of speculation about it. The conventional explanation is that it is at the same age as the second pyramid, which is the pyramid of Khafre. And I find that believable.
Are these the oldest man-made constructions on Earth?
Oh, not at all. They're certainly, they're huge.
Of this size?
I suppose so, but even in Egypt, if you're talking about construction in stone, the stepped pyramid at Saqqara is considered to be the largest and first great building of stone. And even the tombs of the kings before, although they were made mainly of mud brick, they would incorporate certain elements of stone, stone thresholds, stone doors.
Well, what is it about this specific area that makes it so fascinating, not only to us, but to all of our ancestors? Alexander the Great was a tourist. Napoleon was a tourist. This is one of the most famous places on Earth.
It really is. I think it's the most famous archaeological site in the world, and it just offers a commanding view of the surrounding desert and, of course, the modern Cairo now. When you get there, you're just so struck by the monumentality of these buildings that there's not one, not two, but three. The Sphinx is there, the hundreds and hundreds of so-called mastaba tombs. Mastaba is an Arabic word for bench, and the private tombs tend to look like Arabic benches. So the monumentality of the entire site. It's so vast and requires so much study. It's just overwhelming when you get there for the first time.
And it's as though they created a world in stone so many thousands of years ago, which is not indestructible, but has lasted in such an impressive way until present times.
And what's so amazing is I was in Egypt 2 years ago. What's so amazing about it literally is you're in a big modern city, and then suddenly on your left, boom, there are the pyramids, and behind it, desert.
The desert, all the way to Libya, right. It's a fascinating place, and when you get inside the tombs and you see the beautiful carvings and paintings on the tomb walls, what you notice are that these are frozen moments of ancient Egyptian life and culture. So you see just about every type of activity represented there for thousands of years preserved.
Who was George Reisner, and why and when did he go to Egypt?
Well, Reisner was born in 1867. He died at the pyramids in 1942, and he had an interesting career. He was Harvard educated, went to Berlin, and that's where he caught the Egypt bug. He was originally schooled in Semitic languages and Assyriology. He went to Cairo in the 1890s, and he thought he'd spend a year working on the cataloging project at the Cairo Museum. And that's when he met Mrs. Phoebe Apperson Hearst, the mother of William Randolph Hearst. If you've seen the movie Citizen Kane, you know those characters there. But Phoebe Hearst was a great patron of the arts, and she offered him a job. She said, turn the corner, become an archaeologist, and I'll pay you for 5 years to learn how to dig. That's what Reisner did. He became one of the world's greatest pioneering scientific archaeologists, and the rest is history.
When did he go to Egypt?
For the first time, I believe he was there in 1899, I believe it was, or 98.
And what was he going to do during that first time?
Well, the first time was an international collaborative project to document objects in the Cairo Museum. So as he often joked later, I went to Cairo to stay for a year, and I ended up staying 40.
And then he turned to excavation.
He certainly did. With Phoebe Hearst's guidance and support, he decided to learn the ropes at the so-called less important sites along the Nile. And then in about 1902, the concession for the Giza pyramids came up. And he and an Italian expedition and a German expedition were all interested, and they divided the site among them.
And what do you mean by the concession came up?
The opportunity for foreign institutions that were professional and had high professional standards to excavate at their own expense a site. And the site of Giza, of course, was a very, very important one. Reisner was so methodical and had such high standards that he was greatly concerned that the people who were excavating there did not have the proper respect and the proper knowledge to do it thoroughly. And so the Egyptian government agreed to divide this site among, in this case it was American and Italian and German specialists who would take it upon themselves to do the excavation. And of course the objects would be divided between the Egyptian government, who would take what they needed for the Cairo Museum, and the institutions themselves.
Larry, how did excavations then differ from excavations today?
Well, there are many ways in which they do, but the motivation for them and your expectations changed are different now, too. Nowadays, we excavate not to build up a collection, but in the old days, you excavated for knowledge and to build up a collection. Reisner himself would say that museum objects were simply the byproducts of scientific exploration. But it was expected at that time that this was a way to build up a collection. And so, acquire knowledge at the same time.
And how many archaeologists back then were being paid by folks like Mrs. Hearst, or how many were being paid by museums?
Mrs. Hearst actually was funding the expedition for the University of California. So she was not doing it for herself, but this was for the University of California. And Reisner was acting on behalf of Harvard University and the Museum of Fine Arts Boston.
But the gentleman who discovered Tutankhamun, for example, he had a private employer.
He was acting on the behalf of Lord Carnarvon, who had the concession from the Egyptian Antiquities Service. there were certain exceptions that were granted to private institutions. But Carnarvon, although he was the funder, was not the actual excavator, and so he would employ people like Howard Carter who did have experience.
So, what did George Reisner send back to the MFA?
Well, lots and lots. That's really the reason the Museum of Fine Arts collection is so fine, one of the very, very best in the country today. And so 50% of what he found went to Cairo, or to Khartoum in the cases of his Nubian excavations, and 50% came to Boston.
How extensive is the MFA's Egyptian collection?
It's one of the largest and most important in the country and in the world, too. It's actually Egyptian art, Egyptian antiquities were among the first works of art acquired by the museum back in 1872, 2 years after the museum was incorporated. And Bostonians were very fond of Egyptian art. Before we started our own excavations, we received objects that were excavated by the British Egypt Exploration Society. And the popularity of Egyptian art was in large part the motivator for the museum to start excavating on its own.
Is Reisner, Larry, considered or credited with building the collection?
Building that part of the collection, which is the unique part of the MFA collection, we have in Boston, on account of Reisner's activity at Giza, the finest Old Kingdom collection of Pyramid Age objects outside of Cairo.
What could folks see in the Egyptian collection if they visited the MFA this afternoon?
They could see magnificent statues of the builder of the Third Pyramid at Giza, and they can see fantastic portraits of his family and high officials and other people who lived at that time.
But there's a lot they cannot see.
There is a lot that they cannot see because Reisner was very meticulous.
He was big on documentation.
Big on documentation, and so we have the great masterpieces, but what we do have and what most people what wouldn't be interested in seeing are the small finds that actually make the masterpieces all that much more valuable because we are not recovered in a vacuum, but we also have the entire history. We know where they were and what they were found with.
So what we have is a Giza archive unrivaled for its thoroughness, containing information available nowhere else in the world.
Absolutely. I like to think of the galleries as the tip of an iceberg. So when you see a statue in a case, that's really just the beginning of the story. What we have preserved in the museum is the entire history of that piece, where it was found, photographs of it on the day of discovery, diaries that describe the discovery, maps, plans, drawings, everything you can think of.
These materials increase in value as the ancient monuments they document continue to deteriorate and disappear.
That's very true. We have a collection of about 45,000 glass plate negatives. These are photographs that Reisner and his photographers took during the course of the excavations, and they often show monuments, paintings, wall carvings that you can't see today. They're gone.
Plus, Larry, I think you'd agree, the Egyptian runes themselves and Giza and certainly elsewhere in Egypt are being threatened by things like pollution and tourists.
And the growth of the population, which encroaches upon the sites, just as we talked about in the beginning, the pyramids, which used to be far from Cairo, out in the desert, are now abutting the modern structures.
How has Giza changed since the days of Reisner? Would he recognize the site? Obviously, he would recognize the principal monuments, but what would look different to him?
Well, obviously open to tourism, certainly, and the surrounding monuments. I think it was much quieter in his day, and the vista from his viewpoint, he lived at a place called Harvard Camp, which was just west of the Second Pyramid, and he could see all the way to downtown Cairo, which was not particularly large. Nowadays, downtown Cairo has expanded right to his doorstep.
How difficult is it to get permission to dig on Giza today, and are there any excavations ongoing?
Well, you need permission from the Supreme Council of Antiquities, headed by our friend and colleague, Dr. Zahi Hawass, and one goes through a formal application process. And there are foreign excavations and Egyptian excavations all over the country. Giza is mostly reserved for Egyptian work, but there is one American excavation very active now by our colleague Mark Lehner, and he's working just to the south of the site.
I recall on my visit to the site that there was a museum that they built for a boat that they had excavated. And it's my remnant recollection that another boat was left in the ground.
Well, that's true. It's a spectacular thing to see. You shouldn't miss it if you get to Giza. In 1954, during some clearance on the south side of Khufu's pyramid, this amazing boat pit turned up, and a life-size dismantled funerary boat of Khufu was found. And that has since been restored and put back together, and you can see it right on the south of the pyramid. A second boat is in worse condition, but it has been left in place in its boat pit, and eventually that will be recovered and restored.
Might there be other spectacular finds there that we don't know about?
They're happening all the time, to the south of the site, in the cemeteries to the west, everywhere. It seems hardly a year goes by that a new tomb isn't discovered, or a new statue, or new inscriptions to tell us more about the history.
And in Egypt generally, this is a question that we get asked all the time: has everything been discovered? And I'm always happy to say no, but not at all. There are new discoveries being made all the time.
So you guys over at the museum have this huge archive of documentation that has been or is threatened just by age. Enter the Giza Archives Project. Peter, when and why did you come up with this idea?
Well, we've had this overwhelming amount of records and documentations for a long time and watched scholars struggle with their dissertations and their projects, trying to come to Boston with limited time and trying to get a handle on all this material. And thanks to the Andrew Mellon Foundation in New York, beginning in the year 2000, we were able to finally solve this problem. And that means taking all of the photographs, all the diaries, the notes, the plans, scanning them, linking them in databases, and getting them up on the website for scholars and the interested public, all of it linked together in a manageable way.
The goal is to provide integrated online access to the archives documenting the museum's Giza excavations from 1905 through 1942, and assumingly beyond.
That's right, and beyond. We deal with Giza past, Giza present, and we hope to deal with Giza future. So we want to become the online central repository for all the archaeological
activity.
So
this is a multimedia repository of data for research, effectively reconstructing the ancient environment?
That's right. You could go on to mfa.org/Giza, G-I-Z-A, and at that site, there are about 3,000 tombs, about 30,000 photos, 10,000 maps and plans, 3,000 diary pages, and all of them linked together. So you could type in something as simple as pyramid and see lots of amazing excavation photos. Or if you're a researcher, you could type in an actual tomb number or an object number and study it that way.
What's the challenge of computerizing?
Well, I think it's the difference between taking, say, the yellow pages and ripping them apart and throwing them at you, or linking all the material together in a fashion that is manageable. And that's where the computer and the database and the technology comes into play. By linking a tomb to the statues that were found in the tomb, or a diary entry to the tomb it discusses, this is a way to unite all of this data.
The unifying element around which all of the relevant data is arranged is an individual Egyptian tomb.
That's right. If you
think this is sort of the metaphor made flesh online.
Yep. The centralizing unit is the individual tomb. So think of the mastaba tomb as housing or unearthing tomb reliefs, carvings, inscriptions, statues, objects of daily life, ceramics, all of these things are then linked to the record for that one tomb in our database. We also have a wonderful visual search page where you can play God and sort of look at the site from above, zoom in, and every single tomb is a rollover button that you can click on. And once you click on a tomb, the website then assembles all of those photos and drawings and diaries and brings them right to you.
The archive will enhance the study of Egyptian civilization during the Pyramid Age. What periods of history are we talking about?
The dates, it's the 2200 BC, thereabouts.
Through?
Oh, we're only talking about a few generations, as a matter of fact. And then after the Fourth Dynasty, the pyramid field was not used until, very interestingly, about the 6th century BC, there was a revival of interest in the past, and the ancient cemeteries once again became fashionable places for the elite to be buried. So in addition to the Old Kingdom material, there is from our standards, relatively recent material, but still quite old.
The online site, however, is going to enhance a study of this time in a way that's not possible at the actual site itself.
That's true, because
why not?
So many of the tombs are either reburied or inaccessible or closed to the public, or they're in a much worse state of preservation today than they were in Reisner's time. So if you're studying a very important inscription, chances are one of our photos from 1905 will show you a lot more of that text than you would see today.
In fact, if you want to go into the Great Pyramid today, you need to show up at 8 o'clock in the morning to buy a ticket, because they only sell a limited number of tickets in the morning and then again, I believe, in the early afternoon.
Right, and I think they have a rotating schedule of closing the three pyramids on different rotation schedules to allow them to breathe and give them a bit of a rest from the public.
And once upon a time, you could literally go up and touch the Sphinx, and today you cannot do that anymore. You are sort of limited by the way they've set it up for tourists. You can take a picture or look at it from the top of a nearby tomb.
Right, unless you have friends in high places. True.
This is going to be allowing scholars unprecedented access to archaeological materials.
We hope so. We hope the Giza project becomes a role model, not only for other archaeological sites in Egypt, but many other archaeological sites around the world. The data changes, but we all have the same problem. We all have massive amounts of finds, massive amounts of data. It all needs to be organized and made manageable so that you can do the study, the analysis, the comparisons that you need to make in order to answer those big questions.
And you don't have to worry about what hours the museum is or isn't open.
Right, the web is always open, so you're not governed by the hours the site is accessible. You're not governed by the hours the library is open, but you can be there at your leisure. And it really is wonderful, the types of material and the amount of material that's available to you and the problems that have already been solved in the processing of it. People have figured out, what is this name? What does this handwriting say? And you don't have to do that for yourself anymore.
The archive will answer research questions that today cannot even be posed.
We hope so. We've found so many links by putting this material together. And now we're collaborating with our international colleagues in Europe and in Cairo. There are about 5 or 6 other good Giza collections around the world, and we can then solve what I call the Swiss cheese effect, the fact that one tomb was dug by the Germans and another tomb by the Italians and another by the Americans. Putting it all together lets you pose those big research questions.
Is that what's actually happening now? Are you learning stuff or seeing things in different ways that you hadn't even considered because everything is being collated?
We are. We can find, say, a head from a statue in Berlin and find that the body might be in Boston or vice versa. Objects that were assumed to come from one tomb actually turn out to come from a totally different one just because of a little note that a curator wrote in 1942 that has turned up in our records. All kinds of finds.
Is there a Rosetta Stone or stones that helps put all this together?
Well, we know the basic grammatical workings of the hieroglyphic language at that time in the Old Kingdom, about 2500 BC, but every new addition to our data set is always welcome and can certainly help us answer questions about grammar, about art history, about style, costume, ritual, agriculture, diet, you name it.
And so this is going to be helping people deal through or navigate themselves through an overwhelming number of documents, what up till now has been in practical search requirements and certainly limited time and travel constraints under which most scholars work.
Absolutely. We certainly don't want to imply that a visit to see the original objects in Boston and in Cairo isn't worth it. You definitely want to come and see those. But this gives you the overview and a chance to study massive amounts of information in an overviewable fashion.
Larry, as the senior curator in the, you can give your title again?
of ancient Egyptian, Nubian, and Near Eastern art.
What does this mean for you, and is this something that you had ever even imagined when you started your career?
It's something we imagined, it's something we dreamed of, but it's something that is now a reality, and it's terrific work. It makes my job a whole lot easier. It makes it easier for me to work with my collection. It means that scholars who are visiting Boston or inquiring are more focused, more sharply focused. It makes the day easier to find what they need.
Has it given you the opportunity to discover that you have things you perhaps didn't know about?
It certainly has. That and also systematically going through the collections in storage do too. It's amazing. The scale of the excavations was so large, and often a monument was broken up in antiquity and its fragments were scattered, and part of it was found one year in one part of the site, another part of it broken up into fragments was found a couple of years later in another part of the site. It had been sitting in water, it had become discolored, one part had been packed up and sent here, and the other part wasn't packed up until later, so it's not immediately apparent that here we have parts of the same piece, but now we're putting it together again.
And again, this is available to scholars and non-scholars alike.
Absolutely. It's www.mfa.org/Giza, and that will get you onto the website, and we have a wonderful subscriber base all around the world who use it regularly, but it is free and it is open to all.
And what's the time frame for completion?
Completion is a great question. There's always more to be done and better links to be made and additional material to add, and then of course there are the ongoing and future excavations at Giza. So just like any major archaeological site, we'd like to turn this into a sort of a virtual research center that is always rethinking the questions and reorganizing the material.
Is this a new paradigm for museums?
I think so. I think the internet is playing an increasingly important role in helping museums in outreach, in making their collections accessible. One thing I'm very proud of at the Museum of Fine Arts is that they've made the decision to basically put the entire museum's collection online. Many museums are hesitant about that. They just want their 100 highlights or so out there because they're not sure they have all the information correct. The MFA is a leader in that way and has really made the entire collection, not just Egyptian, accessible.
Which is a challenge to us, but it's a challenge to us to keep on improving our records.
Larry Berman and Peter Manuelian of the Museum of Fine Arts, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. Thanks for joining us this morning here at WBCN. Again, the site is mfa.org/Giza. And you are tuned to the Boston Sunday Review on WBCN Boston.